Hi, this is Ron Shapiro. Joining us here today on the RhinoCast, legendary composer, a master of the great American songbook, Mr. Burt Bacharach. Burt, it's a pleasure to have you here today. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me here, Ron. Appreciate it.
Well, we're going to cover some of the obvious questions that, you know, I'm sure you've answered a thousand times, but there's one thing that's been in my mind probably since the first few songs that I heard of you from you in the 60s. You use a lot of French horn or muted trumpet, and it's kind of like a herald or an announcement. You know what I mean? Now, because you wrote the music and not the lyrics up until recently.
Exactly.
Was the use of the horn the way to put a voice in the music, or why those instruments?
Well, that's a good question, interesting one. It is an expressive when I'm, you know, dealing without a voice and dealing with an instrument. Flugelhorns were very appealing to me, just the way they could articulate. I mean, you've got usage and walk on by. You know, it's just I can remember writing like dummy lyrics on trumpet parts on a record date. You know. I mean, just words that really didn't make sense. But instead of having like an eighth note, a quarter note, an eighth note, and another just written in pure music notation, underneath I'd write a lyric that would just say, you know, it could be, I'll be holding on, you know? Okay. Now, musically, trumpet player would play it, dun, dun, dun. But if I ask him to sing, you know, into his horn. I mean, they used to look at me like I was crazy. You know, they say, "Jesus, what is with this guy?" But you know, just like a phrase like "holding on." I mean, if I was to notate that, it would be a quarter note and two eighth notes. Da da da. But there's only one way you're really going to phrase that when you got words. You play "holding on." So I just asked him to sing it, and nobody taught me how to do that. Nobody guided me that way. It just felt right. It was a good instrument. You know, I felt that saxophones sometimes were great. I got into pieces where I've used an oboe as a... It just doesn't have the bend. It doesn't have the undercut. So, yes, you're right, Ron. It is a signature. Not intentional. Nothing's ever intentional, really.
But it's carried through your whole career pretty much, because even on the new album with the muted trumpet, through a lot of it, I almost get the same feeling that at the end of What the World Needs Now is Love, where it's the
it's a baritone horn,
yeah.
Well, you notice you'll hear very little trombone from me, but a baritone horn, yes, on What the World Needs Now is Love. It just felt right for the. I think each song, each piece of music warrants. Whatever I'm hearing in my head, you know. I didn't know how the new album at this time would be structured instrumentally. You know, I don't have – it's always been the way I've written, which is everything gets out of the same bed, you might say. The music gets written as music is being written, or whether it's a song, whether it's a longer piece. I am also hearing what that orchestra might be playing, the orchestration, what's going on behind, where the strings come in, how they're going to be voiced. So they're kind of born at about the same time. I mean, fortunately for me, you know, I've studied music, learned how to notate, learned how to orchestrate, and keep learning how to orchestrate, you know. I mean, I think some of the orchestration that I've written on this new album is, you know, some of the best orchestration I've ever done. But that's the way it's supposed to be. You're supposed to get better as you do things, not stay the same and not get worse, hopefully. I mean, the album I did before 2 years ago with Ron Isley, where they were basically remakes of all these standards, like of mine and Hal's, with two new songs, were really kind of like, you know, I had to reinvent. I didn't want to do The Look of Love yet again, or This Guy's in Love with You, but or Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head, but with Ronnie Isley, you know, you sit in a room and Ron says, I want to do raindrops. I said, geez, I've done it. But, you know, I just played one bar for him, one chord, and he just went, raindrops keep falling on my head. They keep falling on my head. That's just the first bar. And he just suddenly say, hey, I got the clue. I see where it is. It's totally soulful. We'll make a very soulful record out of this thing. So you kind of go with where the music takes you and not try to pre-plan it. The very interesting thing on the new album with the Dr. Dre drum loops, you know, starting from the, you know, we got five drum loops on the new album. And then, you know, one from Prince Board of the Black Eyed Peas and the rest out of Dre's factory, you know. And Dre just gave me seven drum loops. He said, see what you can come up with. And I, you know, it formed the bassist core of, you know, because it would be drums and bass most of the time. And where you go with that. And that kind of says, every four bars, it's the same four bars. I'm not going to change that. Same chord structure, same drum pattern. Now, the challenge is write a melody over that and then have a melody and then have hear where it takes you orchestrally. And in this case, with this new album, it took me to places where suddenly, all right, out of the blue, here come voices singing what I felt about this time. And at this time is a very political album in a way, you know.
Absolutely.
If I've done the album 4 months ago, 5 months ago, it would even be more political. It was done pre-Katrina. It gets done when you think it's done, and you just have no way to know that the worst is still to come. And, I mean, I believe this CD, I have a lot of passion about it. I care a lot about it. I'm very proud of the heritage, my music that's been written, the backlog, all the older songs. This new album means an awful lot to me because, you know, I got two young kids. There's a cut on the album called Where Did It Go? And I'm trying to describe how it felt growing up in New York City and what I could do and the freedom I had. And now having two young kids, a son who just, you know, his late teens, now has turned 20. And what future lies ahead for them? When I was a young boy, 12 years old, growing up in New York City, I could ride the subway by myself and never ever be afraid. Where did it go? And tell me what happened to that world I knew. Is it really gone? So, look, to have won a Grammy for this particular album this year, that was, you know, it was the sixth Grammy, I think, sixth. But the one that means the most to me, because my peers sort of just said, we support you. Then about out on the road for 3 months, you know, doing concerts. Mm-hmm. What I try to do is be, you know, I know why that audience is there, whether I'm playing in North Carolina or in Florida. I know they're there to hear The Look of Love and Raindrops and Alfie and How's Not Home. And you never want to cheat an audience out of what they came to hear, you know. But I do still do new stuff from the album. It's great. Nobody's thrown anything in, you know, on stage yet.
Well, if they're a fan of yours anyway, they would, you know, being that the new stuff, even though, you know, you've written the lyrics for the very first time, it seems
I wrote the lyrics, co-wrote the lyrics with Tony O'Kay.
Okay. But let you get comfortable there. But a fan is going to be a fan. And, you know, if you like the old stuff, you're going to love the new stuff, just as I did. And
well, I, you know, listen, I know you're not going to – not everybody's going to feel like you. I mean, I remember when the record was first coming out and there was an article in the L.A. Calendar section on the front page about my feelings and why I made the album. And I had a private date to play, very lucrative date, very wealthy people, a birthday party, only about 80 people, you know, one of those private dates. And the guy canceled me.
Because of the
policies. My political views, yeah. And I can't tell you, you know, I'm not allowed to say what state or what city it was. But I'm very proud he got canceled, you know. I mean, it really – and
it's not like you really needed his check that week anyway, right?
Yeah. Well, he wanted his original deposit back on top of it, and he wanted me to pay for the act that was going to have to replace me because
you didn't cancel him.
No. We weren't going to do it. And you know, he wanted me, as I say, pay for the new act. And I think the funny thing is that he tried to get Diana Krall, see, to take my place. Which would be just as bad as having me, because Diana's married to Elvis Costello, and
who's on your new album?
Elvis is on the album, and you know, I mean, on the original cut, the way we made it on "Who Are These People," Elvis sings at the end. See, we got to make a change, or we're all fucked. And nobody has ever said fucked, and so emotional like Elvis. And I told Elvis, when I got the phone call from the record company, they didn't want to go with it, that we weren't going to get, you know, it would preclude our chances of getting into Kmart or anything like that. And I said, we're not going to get in Kmart anyway, you know, I mean. But I went with them. They said, you're saying enough on the lyrics of "Who Are These People?" You know, who are these people that keep telling us lies? How do these people get control of our lives? And who'll stop the violence because it's out of control? Make them stop. You know, there is a download, apparently. The record is out now.
I was just going to mention that. X-rated. You can get it, yes.
Yeah, you can get the X-rated version, which has that change at the end. So I'm glad it's out there. You know, Elvis is glad that it's out there. But, you know, as far as you're saying, well, everybody's going to love it. Not necessarily. You know, I remember when it did come out, as well as getting canceled from the from the party. And we went back and offered to say, hey, we won't do anything from the new album. We'll just play the old songs. Because all his friends knew I was coming.
Mm.
80 people. People that were invited knew that I was coming. Okay, what's the reason going to be that I'm not playing? Did I have a conflict? Was I sick? No. You got to tell the truth or we don't have a deal here, you know. I don't know what I intended to do. Sue for stamping on artistic freedom, you know. Mm. But when the record came out, I remember my son Oliver showing me, you know, some of the mail that was coming in on the internet. One guy said, I can't wait for this album to come out so I can pee on it. So, jeez. You see, not everybody feels the same way.
No, I guess not. But anyway, getting back to
the – One last thing. One last thing. That, you know, as far as a sound bite, I thought of it. I won the Grammy. I had Oliver and Raleigh, my two kids, with me. I went through the press line. And the constant question was, why would you make an album like this after a lifetime of writing love songs and never rocking the boat and never being political, Bert? Why? And I said, I always had trouble with a girlfriend who lies. I've always had trouble with an agent who lies. And I'll always have trouble with a president who lies.
And wow.
That says it all. And I mean it with all my heart.
I mean, because you were writing, you know, even What the World Needs Now is Love, I would think that that could almost have been a political statement back in the 60s,
you know? Sure it was. And, you know, it was, but it was gentle. And it transported itself through many decades, you know? Was it an important song then? Yeah, is it important now? It's so much more important now. And we even make a reference to What the World Needs Now is Love. I sing a little bit on Please Explain, the first track.
Mm-hmm. I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just, there was a song I remember said What the World Needs Now. Just like a little, and different references about love still is in this album. I appreciate what you said about the, you can identify the sound. I don't think I sacrificed anything of the richness or my melodic gift. Peel all these lyrics back on this album, and I'm still a melody writer.
Exactly. Now, and speaking of the melody writer, I mean, most people write in 4/4, 3/4, okay? I was in orchestra back in high school and college. All of a sudden, we got this piece of music for Promises, Promises. I was a good sight reader, I thought. My eyes went cross-eyed. I don't know how many different time signature changes, but you do that a lot in a lot of your songs, but they all flow. Now, how did that become your songwriting signature, I guess, not using the, you know, the standard 4/4, 3/4 thing?
It's just the way I felt the tune came out. Was it intentional to break rules? No. Was it natural? I remember with Anyone Out of Heart, which starts at the 5/4 bar, and then it's a 4/4 bar, and back to 5/4. And at the end, it's a 7/8 bar on the turnaround. And the excitement of a studio orchestra with Dion singing at the same time and making that record, and the puzzlement at first of until, you know, they heard it more than read it, you know. I remember going up to the Apollo Theater. Dion was working there with a house band, and I went backstage, and they were furious at me. I mean, they were angry. They were fighting Anyone Out of Heart. They didn't know what to do. And I said, well, guys, just listen to it. Hear it. Hear it. Instead of counting so much, it's natural. It's natural. Feel it natural. And they still gave me a heart. I said, look, it's in the top 10 in this country. So a lot of people in this country are getting it, you know. You guys are musicians. Get it.
Exactly. Now, being the Promises, Promises with like a Broadway show. Now, these people had to sing it live every night. Did the artists in that show, like, did they
feel
their vault too?
Jerry Orbach had the lead. And to have to do it every night. One, it's not even so much the time signature changes. There were a lot of notes. But there's an urgency to the character, to the role, you know. I mean, all I tried to do is survey what was going on stage and get the emotion of the moment. I mean, that's all when I'm writing for a purpose, whether it's a movie or whatever. And Promises, Promises, he was really angry. So if there are a lot, I wish it wasn't so hard to sing, you know. I mean, you hear Dionne make the record of it, and she just floats through it with greatest ease. Another singer, they're under labor, you know. I mean, it's very tough. But, you know, I think that the urgency of promises, promises, I'm all through with promises, promises now. I don't know how. Well, you know, sure, it changed time signature. But it's almost like if you're playing an instrument and you're singing the lyric in your head, you get it.
Absolutely, because I knew the song before I ever played it. So I'd never seen it written out. So it's almost like seeing somebody's name that you've said forever and ever, and you finally see it how it's spelled. It's like, oh, I didn't picture it like that at all. And so I just kind of faked my way through it because I knew the song. I was able to do it. But, you know, thank God I knew the song. But what about – you mentioned Dionne Warwick. What was it about – her that seemed to be like the perfect, you know, the three of you, you know, Hal, you and Dionne, what was it that made you guys just the perfect combination?
Well, you know, Dionne had this great fluidity vocally, you know, she could just flow through. She also had a kind of reserve iciness enclosed, intimate, but held back. So you could hear sing anyone who ever loved, you know. You knew it was immediately, it was Dionne. You had this reserve, like almost like equated to, you know, they used to build these ships inside of a bottle. It felt like that to me. And then was capable of exploding, you know, and very musical. And it was so the more Hal and I wrote, the more I recorded her, the more I could see what we could get away with, the chances I could get away with.
Because it was, I mean...
I could take it to the limits, you know.
And you did, and she was able to, you know, I don't know how many takes it took in the recording studio, but boy, when you hear those records, it's just, oh my God, they're the best, in my ear, some of the best songs ever when I hear her, you know, between your music and her voice and, you know, the lyrics. It's just...
We had a great run, you know.
Yeah, and, absolutely. In that era, Gene Pitney, obviously, who just passed away, unfortunately. Now, he was there in the beginning, and there's actually two things about that. Number one, any good Gene Pitney stories? Because he was recording before, you know, Dionne got to you.
Was it? Did I record him before Gene?
I think...
Not necessarily, no. I think it came afterwards. You know, I was... You know, there were the R&B acts, which I was very comfortable with, Dionne, whether Shirelles, Chuck Jackson, Tommy Hunt. I mean, I think I got really off the ground musically because I've been writing songs for a year and a half, hard, with different writers, including Hal, taking him to a publisher, having him turn it down, one song after another, or finally getting a song demoed and then somebody would record it after some time. And it wouldn't be like I envisioned, you know. Remember me saying I heard the music. I heard the song. I heard the surround. I heard what the orchestra plays. And somebody else would come in and change the tempo, or they'd say, listen, it's a... You got a three-bar phrase here. Give me an extra bar, and I'll give you so-and-so on the roster to sing the song. But don't make it a three-bar phrase. And A&R men were the guys that controlled the business, whether it was Mitch Miller or whatever, you know. They picked the songs for the artist. So part of me thought they were right, you know. And part of me, the other part, the bigger part, knew that they weren't right. I probably ruined some good songs that way.
But also in the beginning of your career, don't you kind of have to play the game until you can?
Yeah, well, I mean, listen, I mean, you need that first break. And the first break really was, well, we got a hit, you know, with The Story of My Life with Marty Robbins and Magic Moments with Perry Como. And I mean, that's after a year and a half of batting out zero. Did we even have a record before then? But once that burden had been lifted off you, you had a hit record. I mean, those songs don't sound at all like I was going to evolve into the kind of writer, you know?
Right.
That's me being pretty commercial.
Yeah.
Magic Moments. I don't knock the song. I think it's for what it is. It's good. It's a little familiar sounding. It's not the most original song that I've ever or ever will write. You know?
It's no Theme from the Blob, you know.
I'm sorry?
It's no Theme from the Blob, you know. It's like
Well, Theme from the Blob was, you know, there again, write something on commission for the Blob, you know. And try to, and it worked, you know, and it was a hit. I think that was my third hit, you know, so. But it wasn't until an A&R man named Calvin Carter, VJ Records in Chicago, said, want Jerry Butler to record your song, Make It Easy on Yourself. I think we'd done the demo with that, with Dion, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, great, he's going to do it. He said, no, I want you to do the date, Bert. I want you to be in the studio. I want you to write the orchestration, conduct the band, you know? Make the record the way you feel it. That's the first opportunity anybody let me have. And it worked, you know? And it was a moderate hit. It was an important milestone for me because, you know, it's like trying to get that first movie, your first poem. And so it got me started. I'm always grateful for Calvin because I like the idea. Let me be in the room, have control of what the tempo is, where what the orchestra's playing. I certainly take a lot of feedback from my rhythm section. I mean, I like doing things live. I don't like the process of going in stages. You put a rhythm track and then you add the strings the next day and then you add a percussion player. And I like everybody interacting. I like the singer singing at the same time. If you're working with great singers, you're going to get a vocal. I mean, the Ron Isley album, I mean, those vocals were there. You know, I believe in that. There's something that happens on the actual session with everybody interacting, how the drummer reacts to what the singer's singing and what you get from each other and what the strings feel like, what they're hearing. I mean, on this album, on my new album, I sing only one track completely through. You know, or there is no complete song on this album, but the one I was referring to before, Where Did It Go, you know? And I sang it with the orchestra, maybe we did two takes. Forget the second take, the first take. First take at it. You know, I'm very shy about my singing voice. I'm very careful about how much I sing in a concert. I don't go and do it until well after the first hour. I let my singers take care of that. But, you know, in this case, the strings are playing, the band is playing. There's a good groove going. I'm at an electric keyboard. I do the vocal live. With tears in my eyes because of what is it, when I was a young boy, 12 years old, growing up in New York City, I could ride the subway by myself and never ever be afraid. Where did it go? Tell me what happened to that world I knew. Is it really gone? How did we wind up in this place instead? Is it really gone? And the next verse was simply, now I have a boy who's 12 and a girl who's 9 and a son in college and I worry about them all the time. Worry about their future. What will it bring? Because nobody is safe these days? Where did it go? And you see, tears in my eyes singing it. I never get a more heartfelt performance. And that's in front of people. That's in front of a band. You ordinary everything. Let me make the track, send everybody home, and I'll go into a vocal booth and do the vocal.
Yeah, but you can hear the emotion in that song. I could tell how personal it was to you when you sang it.
Because it's real.
Yeah.
It's real honest. And, I just think it's probably the most honest album that I've ever dealt with.
Yeah, that sounds it too. You're talking about when you sing in concert. The one thing that I noticed when I've seen you a few times, you always reserve one song for you, and it's Alfie.
Yeah.
Why is that your favorite song, or why is that the song you always choose to sing?
Well, I think if you had to say to me, you got to pick one song, gun pointed at your head. You got to pick a favorite song, I give you four or five favorites, but you got to pick one. I'd say Alfie. I'd say Alfie because, it's a brilliant lyric that Hal David wrote. And the process on writing that was always different, you know. Sometimes you had the music first or part of the music and then Hal would, the lyric or whoever I was writing with. And the lyric was basically written because it had to really project what the movie was about. So I worked very hard on it. And it took a form because of the way where the lyric brought me. And I could feel that song. I think, for instance, I know my limitations as a singer, but I can make that song most of the time happen and be believable because I believe those words are so important. What's it all about, Alfie? Is it just for the moment we live? What's it all about when you sort it out, Alfie? Are we meant to give to more than to live more than we? See, I can sing better than
recite.
Good
thing we're not in. You need the piano. That's probably the problem.
Exactly. No, that wouldn't happen if I was singing. But reciting, never been good at that. But that's a wonderful lyric, and I'm comfortable closing the show with that. And sometimes I do it very well on stage, and sometimes, it's hard to do anything over and over again, and still retain the freshness. I mean, that goes for everything.
Well, I mean, you've only been singing it for almost 40 years, so it's understandable if there's a time that maybe I'll sing another song this.
For instance, it's a much easier song for me to sing than Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head is a very tough song to sing for me.
That's interesting.
I don't understand it. Maybe it's not the key. The key should work. It's just a tough song to sing. Yeah. And yet, when I taught BJ, because he was going into the movie, he's not too far away from my interpretation of how I'd sing that song.
And I heard he had a cold that day, I think, when he recorded it. Wasn't that – like he was sick as a dog and he had like a couple takes in him. I don't know.
I don't remember that. I know we recorded – recorded the record in New York and we recorded him for the movie because I was scoring that film, Butch Cassidy, out here on a soundstage. And I don't remember that he was sick. I remember he was scared to death.
Oh, maybe that's what it was. Maybe he just said he was sick.
He was scared out of his wits, but he still delivered.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
That's what happens with artists.
Yeah.
They deliver.
Absolutely. You've done so many movie songs, and some of the songs that you've written for movies actually didn't make it into the movie but still became hits. They were able to stand on their own.
Yeah.
Like The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, and even That's What Friends Are For was Night Shift, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was in the movie, and Rod Stewart sang it at the end. That wasn't the way I heard that song,
No.
No, definitely not. And I got to make it the way I heard it, I mean, I didn't have control of the record. Oh,
thought I'd feel this way. And as far as I'm concerned, I'm glad I got the chance to say that I do believe I love you. And if I should ever go away, well then close your eyes.
So it's just, I just always find it's that your songs, just because they're written for a movie, they don't need the movie to still be successful. A lot of, you know, songs that were the movies flop, but your songs went to number one. You know what I mean?
I think it's an exciting premise to just to write to. I mean, What's in a Pussycat never would have been written had I not been writing that score and watching that over and over. Peter Sellers, what is craziness? And you keep watching it and watching it. Put it on rerun. Go back, fast forward. Hear it, look at them again. And then you start hearing a melody that would contour it. Same with The Look of Love, right off of Ursula Andress's body in Casino Royale.
Hmm.
See? Right off of her sexuality, her sensuality. And we put Dusty on it, and it became a hit.
Yeah, huge hit. Let me just ask you one real quick question about, because we've mentioned Hal David a few times. How did you hook up with him?
I met Hal David in the Brill Building, which is famous 1619 Broadway. It was like the music factory, floor after floor of music publishers where you'd write in different offices. I was introduced to him. We wrote a couple of songs. We wrote some bad songs initially, songs like Peggy's in the Pantry. You'll never hear that. Underneath the Overpass. But I liked him, and he'd had it. You know, he was older than me, been in the business longer. He'd been a songwriter way longer than me. I'd just been out trying to make a living on the road conducting for acts. And, you know, he wrote with different people, and I wrote with Hal maybe 2 days a week and somebody else 2 days a week. But I tried. I worked. But God, he's good. He's good. He's good.
I mean, the two of you, I think, you know, just what, you know.
And I appreciate Hal. So much more now, and so in the last 10 years, so much more than I did. You know, at the beginning, it was like, give me a great sound. Wait a minute, on that note up there, Al, I don't care whether it makes any sense. Just give me an open word where it would be really emotional. I'd give him a word that I wanted to sound like, and instead of just hearing what he was saying lyrically. But now I really look and scan those lyrics, and they are something.
Absolutely, absolutely. And just the very last question, because the whole new generation knows you now as a movie star, okay? There's people just coming up. They said, oh, he wrote some songs? I didn't know that. Did did Austin Powers kind of like jumpstart you maybe a little creativity, your creativity a little bit to come up with new songs for the new generation, like this new CD? Or is it just another job that you had where you're just riding in the limo and, you know?
You know, Mike Myers had been a big fan of mine. He made his first movie in Vegas, mostly in Vegas. Nobody knew what kind of picture it would be, but I did it, rode on the bus, played the piano. And it was more like appreciating his humor. Who knew it was going to be this beginning of this huge cycle of three hits in a row? And I'm grateful that he got me in all three movies, you know, because I don't know that it exposed my music. People saw me. It certainly made me well-known amongst the 11-year-olds in this country.
Well, speaking of that, I have a friend whose daughter is 12. Her name is Sarah. She must be able to sing at least 100 of your songs. Your music will live on. And on and on. And I told her dad that I was going to be talking to you today, and he said, would you mind getting a picture signed? Because she actually has a framed picture of Bert in her, not like rock stars, Clay, who had it? Bert Bacharach, you know, the man who was voted, one of the 50 sexiest men in his 70s. But your music will live on. I think you're like the Beethoven and, you know, 120 years from now, 200 years, people will still be playing, you know, Bert Bacharach.
Time will tell.
Melodies.
Time will tell. I don't count on anything. I just get very nervous when I'm mentioned in the same breath with some really great composers. But, you know, as I say, I'm very grateful for the life I've had, you know.
log on to rhino.com. Take a short quiz and enter to win a signed Burt Bacharach box set at rhino.com. Thanks for listening to the RhinoCast. I'm Ron Shapiro.